This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Last month, the United States Supreme Court refused to overturn a lower court ruling that threw out most of North Carolina's voter ID law. So that means that the law's changes to early voting and voter ID requirements, anyway, most of them will not go into effect. The appeals court ruling agreed with critics of the law who said it was an act of racial discrimination. The high court split down the middle on the lower court decision, and that means it stays in effect. And that highlights the impact of the vacancy on the court left by the death of Antonin Scalia. The GOP-led Senate has declined to confirm President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland. NPR's Nina Totenberg has covered the court for more than four decades, and she will be at UNC Chapel Hill on September 20th to reflect on the recent court decisions, that and much, much more. She's Frye Foundation Distinguished Visiting Professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at UNC. Nina Totenberg joins me now. Hello, Nina.
Hi there, Frank.
Let's talk about this latest decision about North Carolina's voting laws. First of all, what was at issue here?
Well, let's just start by saying this wasn't a decision. And it wouldn't have been a decision even if there'd been nine justices and five justices to say that we will grant a stay or not. So what North Carolina was trying to do was go to the Supreme Court and say, look, we think the appeals court was wrong. And while we appeal to you, would you prevent this statute from going into effect, please? Because it's too hard for us to deal with. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to do that. And they made that decision not to intervene at this point by a 4-4 vote. That doesn't tell you how individual justices feel necessarily about the actual law itself, although it certainly gives you some strong hints. That said, there are people who voted to grant a stay, like Justice Kennedy, who could conceivably be persuaded that the law is discriminatory ultimately. But for now, all we know is there were four votes, four justices who said, look, what we see, this is bad enough. We're not letting an election go ahead again, because remember, there was a previous election using this law.
And of course, that's very likely to happen, that a ruling on the actual law itself and not on whether or not to stay the lower court ruling, that's very likely to get to the court. And if it's 4-4, as you say, we don't know for sure it'd stay that way. But that does, raise some interesting questions about this 4-4 split, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, this shows you what the consequences are of having a vacancy on the Supreme Court for now something like 8 months. And it's not just that the Republican-controlled Senate has declined to confirm Merrick Garland. It's declined to even hear his case, hold a hearing. And frankly, even if Hillary Clinton were to win, and even if she were to renominate Merrick Garland, in all likelihood, he wouldn't get confirmed until the end of March at the earliest, meaning that he would only be there to hear cases for the very last 2 weeks of argument at the Supreme Court this term.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, it leaves us in a position, especially when you have what is perceived to be a kind of obstructionist Congress, and we don't know what that's going to be like after November, but certainly up until now, an obstructionist Congress, not a lot getting done in Washington, a tie on the Supreme Court. I mean, does that mean the country is being run by lower courts at this moment?
In some very close cases, it does mean that. It means that whatever the lower federal court of appeals says is what remains the status quo, because there isn't a tie-breaking vote.
And, of course, then you get into the situation that if you have conflicting rulings, as we had in same-sex marriage, that's when the Supreme Court says, all right, well, listen, we have to take this because we've got our lower court ruling in Texas that says one thing and in Ohio says something else. We'll fix it. But, again, with a 4-4 tie, it raises some interesting questions about sort of how we operate going forward, right?
It certainly does. I mean, the court actually avoided ruling on same-sex marriage for many months, and to the surprise of many people, because most of the courts had ruled one way, that is, to allow same-sex marriage. And finally, one court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, went the other way. And at that juncture, the Supreme Court said, all right, the argument's joined. We've got to decide this. Well, supposing there had only been eight justices and they were divided 4-4. I don't know. I guess they would. I don't know what would
happen. Majority wins the most court rulings. And I mean, that does raise interesting questions because, of course, a strategy might be to find an ideologically, you know, sort of supportive judge in your district and take your case to that judge or that panel. And then you can imagine that regionally how that plays out. And you could create a situation where you will have many conflicting rulings in time with a tied Supreme Court.
That's certainly true. And as I recall, the same-sex marriage case that they took was from the Sixth Circuit because it disagreed with other people. And suppose on a 4-4 tie, you uphold the one court that didn't agree with the others. So it's I suppose they don't have to do it that
right.
way. But and in that case, Justice Kennedy would have been the deciding vote anyway. He wouldn't have, it wouldn't have been a 4-4 tie. So regardless, having a vacant seat on the Supreme Court simply adds to the institutional gridlock that we have in this country at this point. In Congress, to some extent, with the White House being stymied by Congress and some individual judges, not even courts of appeal, but individual judges who issue nationwide injunctions overruling something the president did, it's really quite amazing. But one thing I can tell you is it ain't no way to run a country because you don't run it that way.
Well, I'm sure
you are run by events, not by elected leaders or judges or members of Congress.
Well, and you're hoping that the judicial rulings are extraordinary events, that mostly you're operating on the rules that everybody agreed on, and now and then we disagree on how the rules are interpreted. Okay, let's go to the courts. But these days, we're seeing more and more kind of in the other direction. We're waiting for the courts to decide, in the case of North Carolina, to know what to put on the ballots, to know what instructions to give voters who are, you know, going to go.
Well, you know.
Polls.
I mean, for this election, you know. Because when the court tied in this case, it meant that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision was upheld for the purposes of this election,
right.
And this election will be governed not under those laws that were enacted by the Republican-controlled legislature and signed by the governor and fought for by them. For now, though, that law does not apply, at least for this November's election.
Let's talk about another controversial law here in North Carolina, House Bill 2, continuing to make headlines. A federal district judge, Thomas Schroeder, ruled that the university system could not enforce the so-called bathroom law. So, I mean, that there has been a ruling on some part of HB 2. Tell us what that means for us.
Well, I actually don't know. I mean, I'm a great believer in telling you what I've read and I haven't read, and I haven't read his opinion, so I can't tell you what all the practical consequences are. But I imagine the university can certainly make voluntary arrangements. What's happening to North Carolina is that it is seeing very rapidly, and in a way I certainly wouldn't have predicted, the political consequences of that law. It's losing something that is very close to its heart, and that is first basketball from the NBA, which, you know, is having its all-star game there. And then the athletic conferences are saying to North Carolina, well, we're not going to do any of our final games in North Carolina because we object to this law and it means some of our students will be treated unequally. And therefore, the ACC is pulling out and the NCAA is pulling out. And these are not things that I, as a moderate sports fan, would have particularly anticipated. And the question, I began to wonder last night when I was listening to some of NPR's coverage on this, whether the penalty for the state in terms of economics and sports and that sort of thing might not prevail faster than any court ruling.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting speculation, Nina, because when you put it that way, we talk about the gridlock in the institutions of government. They're sort of not producing at the rate we expected. The marketplace is speaking. The common wisdom, the common sense about HB 2 is that it's discriminatory. If you take common sense to mean what big businesses are saying, what major athletics are saying, what big performers and entertainers are saying, large businesses refusing to, the marketplace is taking the place, in a sense, of the political apparatus that seems to be thoroughly stuck.
We'll see if it really does.
And then we'll see if it plays out that way, right.
I mean, we see people on these kinds of issues on both sides can really dig in their heels. I have no idea what will happen. I have no crystal ball on this. But this is one of those cases where, as you say, the marketplace and capitalism may be more effective in this particular instance than the courts are.
Let's talk about some of the other big cases around the country. What do you think are some of the things we should keep our eyes on?
It's very hard to say, in view of the fact that we do have an 8-justice court and we don't know what's going to happen in the election. And I can tell you, looking at the Supreme Court docket this term, the court has been hesitant to grant a lot of big, very, what I would call in the news business, A-plus cases. Mm-hmm. It sort of has tried to push those to the side. And those that it granted before Justice Scalia died, it has put off to later in the to hearing those cases later in the term, hoping apparently that it might get a 9th justice. But yesterday we saw Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell say once again that even if Hillary Clinton wins the election, there will be no lame duck vote on Merrick Garland. That, as I said, suggests you're going to have a seat empty for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, reality is always different than hypotheses. So he said that for sure now. If she were to win and the Democrats were to win control of the Senate, I don't know that there might not be. Certainly, all of the conservative judges I know, very conservative judges, who serve with Merrick Garland are hoping that they will do a lame duck vote if Hillary Clinton is elected, because first of all, they like and respect him enormously, and secondly, they believe that anybody Hillary Clinton is likely to name, if it's not Merrick Garland, is going to be much more liberal and certainly much younger than the nominee who is currently before the Senate and who will not be withdrawn. He only gets withdrawn when the Senate comes to a close, and that'll happen in early January, probably. I think it's the first week of January when the new Senate is sworn in.
Well, let me ask you this, Nina. We said you've been covering the court now for more than four decades. Has it changed? And assuming it has, how? Just coverage of the court, I mean.
Well, it's changed enormously. You know, when I first started covering the court, there was limited coverage, I would say, because the press corps that covered the court was relatively small. And you didn't have to do a lot of stories about the court unless you really wanted to. Today, there in the digital world, there is SCOTUS Blog, which is the blog that covers the Supreme Court and covers it like a blanket. And it was created, in fact, by one of my former interns, Tom Goldstein, who saw a vacuum when he was my intern. Professors have their own blogs. I can't read everything that's published about the Supreme Court. I'm not talking about law review articles. I'm talking about stuff that's published on blogs that's short, that should be consumable. I can't read everything.
Oh, is that just
there's so
is that,
much of it?
Well, is that because there's more to cover, or just because of the way the digital universe works, there's just more people out there doing this kind of thing?
The latter.
Yeah. So what do we need to know as consumers then? I mean, because this stuff is complicated. You have to be kind of careful.
Listen to NPR. It's simple. and you read our website. Just forget everybody else.
That's true. And now, what have you learned in terms of covering the court this many years? How have things changed for you personally and professionally? What do you do differently now?
Well, when I started covering the court, I had two things going against me. I was female. And there was only one other woman who regularly covered the court. And eventually there were two or three of us. So I was female, I was young, and I was unknown. And I would get the worst seat in the house, usually where I couldn't see. I didn't know a lot. I was reading like a crazy woman trying to catch up for the fact that I'm not a lawyer, which has served me very well. I have to understand things like a layperson, but with enough sophistication that lawyers are interested in what I have to say, too. But that takes time to accomplish. It really does take time. So those were, you know, that's how things changed for me personally, you know, we now get the opportunity occasionally to broadcast the audio of a Supreme Court argument on the same day in which it occurs, not at the same time, but on the same day. And for people who are interested in it, you can go to the Supreme Court's website at the end of every week on Friday afternoon. It's not much use to us, but it's for anybody who's interested and thinks they're being left out. You can go listen to an argument right there. You don't have Nina Totenberg as your guide, or but you know what?
Well, then I'm not going to do it. I'm not doing it then.
You're not doing it. There
are people. What I'll do is I'll listen to that and then I'll call you. That's what I'll do.
That's it. There are people who occasionally say, when we get the actual audio, that they miss my reenactments.
Yes, of course. So how important is it to have sources in this business? Because if you think about it, it's not like you're trying to get, you know, sort of the story first. This is about interpreting what, you know, what lawyers and judges are saying. Do you cover news the way other reporters do? And is it important for you to get kind of inside information?
You know, you're not going to get information from a so-called primary source. So you, if you say to a justice, you know, that argument that I heard last week really was terrible. What do you think of it? Or what's going on behind the scenes? They'll throw you out of, forget their office. You probably aren't in their office. They won't talk to you. Be highly improper for them to do that. So the best you can do is sort of understand both the legal and personality personas of these individuals, and have a lot of people who are experts in the fields that are going to go to the Supreme Court who can help you and guide you. And, you know, most of the time, if you have really great people that you deal with on who cover a variety of perspectives, you're not going to goof it up, but occasionally you do.
Not often, Nina. We're happy that you are doing all that work and you are our guide, Nina Totenberg. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Frank. We miss you in Washington, although I'm sure you don't miss the traffic.
I miss you, but no, not the traffic. And thank you so much, Nina. Nina's going to be here, and maybe we'll keep her here. She's going to be speaking at UNC's Frye Foundation Distinguished Visiting Professor in the College of Arts and Science. Her talk Tuesday, September 20th. And I'm talking about Nina Totenberg, of course, NPR's legal correspondent. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. And that's our show for today. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Orman, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.